Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.
By the way, that's the best advertisement for that show I've ever heard.
You're welcome.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
Shenley High School was a world unto itself. By senior year, I had mastered the languages and customs of its various sovereign states, the head nods of Jock Nation, the fist bumps of the Kingdom of Stoners, the innocuous witticisms of the People's Republic of Theater Dorks.
Greg, how was your summer?
Summer? What does that word even mean? Like, more some?
Hello, everybody. It is episode 170 of Wreckatopia. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Jeremy Scott.
Hello, I had a really fun joke I was going to do to make fun of Aaron Arenos.
I
forgot to do my joke.
Was it the joke?
No, I had a whole thing about Earl and the Dying Girl. I was like three sentences long. I was going to end with Enos. It was really funny. I fucked it up.
Amazing. And joined by the aforementioned Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, regretful polar bear arenos.
Oh, I remember what it was. It was going to be comparing the high school lunchroom to the Gaza Strip was questionable in 2015, but in 2025, it's unacceptable arenos.
Oh, yeah.
Good start. We're off to a good start.
We are an incredible start. Today's big recommend is Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. We'd also like to welcome chat who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Thank you very much for coming out. Appreciate you very much. Let's start us off with some small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
Aaron, what do you got?
F1. I loved this movie. I will say, just right off the bat, I do not follow the sport. At all. Didn't even watch the TV show that everybody got into. I heard a lot about it, but I just never got into it. Haven't been a racing fan really at all. I was aware of Jeff Gordon when I was younger because he was the rage and, you know, whatever. But I understand that's not F1, that's NASCAR. Mm-hmm. I understand they're two different things. But that's about as far as my racing knowledge. No, I once did clean up the stands after the Indianapolis 500 with my youth group. So there is that.
Really?
So yes.
They used your youth group as unpaid labor?
Yes, this was very...
Did they consider it a mission trip?
Yes. This is one of those things. I went with somebody who is a big fan of F1, and I will say they loved it as much as I did. So it seems to appeal to whether or not you follow the sport. And here's the reason I really like it. First of all, Kaczynski just knows how to tell a story. This is Joseph Kaczynski, of course, who did Top Gun Maverick and many other movies. Only the Brave, right?
Isn't that?
Which is kind of an underseen one of his, but just makes great movies. And I think putting my finger on it this time, it has so much to do with his ability to ride the line of trope and cliche and formula and still make it feel like they're authentic characters you want to be hanging out with. So there's a way you can trip over that line and it just feels, you know, tropey and cliche and, oh, you know, movies or whatever. And he has this way of taking, you know, what may feel syrupy and saccharine in other directors' hands and just making it interesting and real and fun. His movies are just so fun. And this is no different. Brad Pitt's great in this. I don't think he's asked to do a ton of capital A acting, but in the couple scenes that he does, I think he's up to the task. I mean, I'm really excited to see later stage career Brad Pitt. I think there's a Redford path for him. in his later career that could be really, really interesting and fun. Kerry Condon's amazing, as she always is. I love Damson Idris, who plays opposite Brad Pitt as these teammates. And I guess one of the things you learn about F1 is your biggest rival isn't necessarily the other teams. It's your teammate, right? Because you're driving the same car. So the only person on the track that you can really gauge yourself against is your teammate, because he's the only one on the track driving the exact same car that you are. And so there's these interesting rivalries that happen, is my understanding. So I haven't mentioned Javier Bardem, who's also really fun in this. This is just a great watch. It's just a great watch. It's 2.5 hours, but it flies by. Be aware of that for bladder reasons or whatever reasons
you need. Kaczynski does really well for me, in addition to characters you want to hang out with, which is, I think, a really great description, is just the visuals. Like the even the trailer for this movie showed me racing in a way I'd never seen it before. And my brother watched that show you're talking about, and never watched F1, but watched that Netflix show and is now obsessed with Formula One. So is his daughter. I can't wait to hear what they have to say about this, because, you know, they've been watching these races for 2.5 years that Brad Pitt has been at filming slowly over time. Yeah, I'm pumped to see it. I'm glad that you liked it so much.
I watched this. I enjoyed it. I watched it in fake IMAX, where it's, you know, it's the screen and it's bigger, but it's not fully the screen like what, you know, a real IMAX does. But it's I definitely agree. I enjoyed it, definitely. The Bruckheimer Days of Thunder stuff is all back in this. You can I mean, you can really tell that Bruckheimer is behind this one.
Yep.
I also wasn't entirely a fan. Now, maybe your F1 friend explained this to you later on, but that the fact that the best driver is often not the fastest driver or whatever. I mean, you have to use your head. You have to know when to go in and pit and all that other stuff. But I found some of the techniques of kind of skirting the rules to win races not very satisfying, and that's
the angle shooting, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. So there's like a good chunk of the movie is dedicated to, oh, look at that wily Brad Pitt, he knows the rules better than anybody and he knows how to skirt them. And like you have kind of fun with that at first, and then it, like, the next race they're still doing more like, ooh, look at this cheeky thing you can do too. So I wasn't like a big fan of that. I was also, and maybe it's because it's the fake IMAX that I was watching it in, I wasn't pulled in completely by the driving, especially because of the way they did the races a lot of times. It feels like a lot of times that, you know, if speed and like being the best at driving your car is the way to win these races, then I would have seen a little bit more. Maybe I've seen a little bit too much of this like IMAX like white knuckle type of stuff lately, and it's wearing off on me. I don't know. I felt like the Ford versus Ferrari races were more exciting than the ones that are in this one, but I enjoyed it. I didn't want to mean to like completely shit all over this movie, because I really liked it, but still there were some things about it I was like, I would have liked to tweaked a couple things.
Kaczynski, sure.
Kaczynski is openly teasing the idea of Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise Days of Thunder F1 like crossover.
Yeah.
Like, he's openly in interviews saying these two guys surely raced against each other when they were coming up in some kind of racing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, that movie's gonna make so much money.
Yep. Definitely.
If they ever make it.
Definitely. For sure.
I know Cruise has already been talking about a sequel to Days of Thunder. Mm-hmm. So this feels like a
Hey man, that's his life these days. The Mission Impossible sequels and a Top Gun sequel, and like, let's, you know, he's kind of gotten into that whole like, I wanted make stuff that people go to, and you know, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just it's not surprising that after he tried all those new movies for a really long time, then those didn't really take off, that he's just like, let's do Mission Impossible. Let's do Top Gun. Let's do Days of Thunder. Let's do Risky Business too.
So. Decades of Thunder, coming soon to a theater near you.
I did see an interview with Brad Pitt a couple weeks ago where somebody asked him about reuniting with Tom Cruise in a movie, and he was like, well, as long as we stay on the ground, I'm not going to be hanging off airplanes and shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. All right. I watched a movie over the weekend. It was one of these times where we get together with buds and watch movies and everything on a movie night. And one of the picks, one of the selections was Shadow of a Doubt, the Hitchcock movie from 1943. I swear, Aaron, you small recommended this once, but I could not find it in our emails.
Interesting. I thought I did too, but I didn't research it or whatever. I don't mind talking about it again. Yeah. As many people need to see this movie as possible.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
I agree. I felt like you had, and I nearly shied away from it, but then I saw that I couldn't find it. So anyway,
sure.
Joseph Cotten is playing a guy who's definitely on the run from some people. So are they law enforcement? Are they gangsters? We don't know at the beginning of this movie. And then he decides, I'm going to hide out with my family that I haven't seen in many years. And it's his sister who's like a mother to three children. This is an odd family, by the way. It's one of the biggest age ranges amongst actors and whatever I've ever seen. So Joseph Cotten, who's 38, his sister's like 51. This is like actual ages of the actors when the movie came out. His sister's like 51. Her husband, who's the guy who plays Clarence in It's a Wonderful Life, is like 69. They have an older daughter who's in her 20s. And then there's like two other kids who are like 10 and 11 or something like that. It's one of the oddest families. Anyway, he goes to hide out at their place. And he definitely doesn't want to tell them why he's here. He's just here to, we're here to visit. I'm just, you know, whatever. And at some point, a newspaper comes in and it's speculating about somebody that the cops are looking for and that has killed wives for money over the years. Doesn't know the name, doesn't have a picture, but he's not going to be found out in any way. So he cuts that article out of the newspaper before anybody in his family can read it. Of course, the oldest daughter figures out that he's cut out the article for some reason, and now there's a bunch of suspicion about why he did that. Why would he do that? And meanwhile, the cops start getting closer, and they start closing in on him, and they start trying to get a picture so that they can send it to other people who could verify that maybe this is the guy they're looking for. But Joseph Cotten doesn't like to have pictures taken of him, and he even in one scene, when somebody like sort of incidentally takes one, he goes over and demands that they destroy the picture. Anyway, to tell you any more about this movie would be a crime, probably. So just know that this is one of those all-time intense Alfred Hitchcock thrillers, and it feels like it doesn't get enough discussion about it, although I have heard it more and more over the years that it, you know, people have started putting it, you know, up there. They don't really talk about this like they do North by Northwest or Psycho or Rear Window or right. any of these movies, but it certainly belongs beside them, I believe. And so
I bet there's a train in it.
There is a train in it. There is a train, correct. so there you go.
Well reasoned, Jeremy. Mm-hmm. Well reasoned.
Mm-hmm. That's yep. So yeah,
it is a top five Hitchcock for me. Has been since I became a Hitchcock fan. My mom introduced me to Hitchcock movies mm-hmm. when I was really young, and it's hard to separate that nostalgia for my love for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they're amazing movies. You know. It's crazy to me how old this movie is and how modern it feels in some of the dialogue and the scenes and the stuff that it's doing with these characters. I think it's really good. My favorite side thing is, you mentioned Henry Travers, I think is the guy's name.
Henry Travers,
from It's a Wonderful, Wonderful Life. My favorite running gag is how he and his friend are always trying to create the perfect murder together and like trying to one up each other.
And that's,
with, you know,
Hume Cronin plays his best friend.
Yes.
In that. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. This is just a really fun, tight, tense movie that everybody needs to watch. It's
yeah,
great.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah. Mm. It's kind of crazy. This movie's like 82 years old.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah. So.
Ugh.
You old.
Jaws is celebrating its 50th anniversary, guys. Mm-hmm, that's right. Mm-hmm. Jaws is half a century old.
That's,
welcome
that's
to
correct.
Our aged past.
Yep.
Of course, Jaws came out the year I was born. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes.
Well,
exactly.
And when Star Wars turns 50, that's my year. So there you go.
Wow. There you go. My small recommend has nothing to do with feeling old, and it is season 4 of The Bear, which was recently dropped on Hulu. And the discourse around this show online has got to chill the F out. Like, this show has, we've decided on the internet to put this show under a microscope for weird reasons. Clearly. Season 3 was Dune Part 1, and Season 4 is Dune Part 2, and they split us in the middle, and I want to tell you what the discourse around The Bear Season 4 needs to be, and it needs to be amazing! It needs to be a show. This show has never been about food, people. This show has always been about trauma, and finally, in Season 4, 99% of the characters in this show, all of whom have deep trauma, decide to try and heal.
Mm-hmm.
And watching that journey was magical for me. I cannot tell you how many times I saw authentic behavior from people with trauma who are trying to heal. And I saw authentic dialogue and arguments from people with shared trauma who are trying to heal but are on separate journeys. And it's full of amazing performances. There are cameos I didn't expect. I think the show could end right here with 4 seasons, even though it does not tie everything off at the end. It feels emotionally like a good spot to end. I'm rambling as all hell, and I hope that what that does is tell you how jacked I am about this season. If you thought season 3 was too much yelling, fighting, and angst, season 4 is your antidote. And yes, it's probably right up there with season 2 as far as my favorite seasons of this show. And I appreciate that it chose growth this year as a theme, even though it was a bumpy road for many. I loved it. I loved it so much. I'm going to stop.
Maybe the first time in a long time that in the 3-panel version of this podcast, I've seen everything that everybody's talking about. Oh, wow. So yeah, I also blew through season 4 of The Bear. I've been enjoying the show since it came out. And yeah, I agree with you. And I think this is one of those things that had they continued with the normal thing with this show, which is, you know, this guy like constantly in his head, constantly like, oh, I've got to be the best of the best of the best and all that, that gets tiresome after a while. And I know for some people that's the origination of the drama that they're looking for. But for me, I was glad that it took this direction, because I feel like you are just retreading your old stuff when you start saying, well, he just can't get out of his head, man. He's just a perfectionist, and he's always going to be this asshole and whatever. And it's just like, man, can we have any kind of change whatsoever? It reminds me a little bit of like when The Last Jedi came out, whatever your feelings are about that movie, where it's like Rian Johnson's thing, whether you felt that was a successful change to the story or not, he was basically telling you need to stop talking about your childhood and just, we need to move to another story, or else this is going to die. And I felt like that's the way The Bear approached season 4. And And it's so good. It's so well written, and yeah, I highly enjoyed this. I'm glad that you loved it. So,
yeah, this show's phenomenal. I'm gonna say something that might sound a little like dating with faint praise for some, but for me, you have to understand that this is high praise. This has rolled out a lot like Lost for me. The first couple seasons of Lost, I think, are transcendent television. And I think the same about the first two seasons of The Bear. Just absolutely transcendent, incredible writing, performances, drama, story, plot, characters. Like, on every level, the show was hitting. It was one of the reasons, and I think we even came out of season two, Jeremy, I remember having a conversation with you about how hard it was going to be for the show to keep this up. Like, how do you keep, you know, getting better? And then season three came up and we went, oh, maybe you don't keep it up completely. And it just felt like it was hitting this space of treading water a little bit and trying to get to the next thing. It felt like there was a request to do more seasons instead of just three. And so we're going to stretch this one season out into two kind of things. And I think season three really, really suffered. In fact, if I'm being honest, I actually think I was worried after the first three episodes of season four. I'm just going to be honest. I don't think there's a lot the first three episodes of this season do to change my feelings on kind of that treading water feeling. But man, when we hit episode four, which is the one that I always pronounce wrong and correctly, Adabiri, I believe. I think she wrote it, and it's basically a bottle episode with her.
That's a great episode.
So good. It is so good. And then
Danielle Deadwyler, too.
Yes, bring it in. This show brings people off the bench like it's, you know, the most stacked team to ever play any kind of sport. Like, it is, you know, Danielle Deadwyler coming in. There's a moment. By the way, I could have an hour spoiler conversation on The Bear. Like, there's so many things I want to talk about. But there's this singular moment in that episode where Danielle Deadwyler code switches when she gets on the phone. And it is so brilliantly subtle and interesting and says so much. And, like, there's just that kind of stuff throughout this show. I think 4, 7 in the finale are my three favorites. 7, of course, is going to be a lot of people's favorite. It's everybody coming together. They clearly wanted to reuse the giant table from the season of the rehearsal for that wedding episode. That's the only explanation for
biggest
what
table ever.
Yes, for what goes on there. It's so brilliant.
But I mean, even that episode brings back people from the fishes episode, and you're expecting trauma, and even those people are more interested in healing than trauma. Like, God, it just felt like the message of the whole season was you have to be active in healing.
That conversation that Carmi has with Saul Goodman is so good. And so unexpected and so beautiful. The conversation he has with his mom, like, it's just those moments throughout the latter half of this season are just excellent. So just like Lost, it finishes with the greatest finale, and it's just unarguably so.
Until they throw enough money at him to bring him back for
season 5. And that's okay. I mean, that's okay. I kind of want it to be, to be done because I want it to live in the snow globe I've created. But if they have more things to say, I guarantee they'll say them well. And you're right. There are things left completely up in the air from early in the season. Okay. So one more specific thing. There's this moment where they're doing this special thing for somebody that's come to the restaurant. And this is one of the, it's seen by somebody and that's left up in the air, whatever. I kind of want an anthology spinoff of The Bear that's just those stories. So that our characters from The Bear maybe make cameos in the background, but it's about people who come to the restaurant every week. I don't know. Anyways,
oh, man. Oh, man. But that moment, I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about
it's
right
so good.
Now.
It's so good.
Anyway, I'm glad you both liked it.
Mm-hmm. All right. It's time to get on to our big recommend, which is me and Earl and the Dying Girl. And this is Aaron's pick. So take it away, Aaron.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here. American Family Insurance can help protect your dream home for whatever comes next. You can live in your own oasis or your own clubhouse. Whatever you choose, get the right coverage. Save up to 23% by bundling home and auto. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at amfam.com.
Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies. 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Me and Earl and the Dying Girl is a 2015 film written by Jesse Andrews and directed by Alfonso Gomez Rajon. Alfonso didn't really direct any other films, you probably remember, but Andrews went on to have a story credit on Pixar's Luca and the upcoming Pixar original Hoppers, so clearly he's amazing. We start with high school student Greg, played by Thomas Mann, doing some narration about not knowing how to start his story, before starting his story with an absolute banger of an opening line about murdering someone through the art of filmmaking. He then leads us through his strategy for surviving high school, which involves applying for and balancing citizenship in all the school's different clique groups, and avoiding hot girls because mooses can't help but kill chipmunks or something. We meet his friend Earl, played by R.J. Kyler, as they sit in an office and watch some Fitzcarraldo. Ironic, considering the earlier killing people while making movies joke. The office belongs to the teacher that he says is the only reasonable adult at the school, Mr. McCarthy, even though we know that man is secretly the Punisher. Next up, his parents, played by Connie Britton and Nick Offerman, barge in on his personal time to have a conversation about what's after high school, and more importantly, let him know that his friend, Cough, actually just an acquaintance, Cough, had been diagnosed with leukemia, and his strategy of kind of being friends with everybody means his parents now want him to be there for her. So he calls to see if she wants to hang out. She says she doesn't, but his mom apparently didn't get the memo that no means no, because she's making him go anyway. Cut to Molly Shannon, who is Denise, Rachel's mom, hugging him for an uncomfortably long time and calling him things like yummy. But she's going through a rough time, so let her creep a little bit, okay? Greg convinces Rachel that he has to hang out with her for a bit because his mom will be a total pain if he doesn't, so he charms her with some literal pillow talk before Earl calls him away. By the way, if you're craving more falling in love with your pillow drama, good news. Big Mouth would take the concept and run with it to a disgusting length as an entire season-long plot arc just a couple of years later. So you're welcome.
Yep.
Back to the movie.
That, by the way, that's the best advertisement for that show I've ever heard.
You're welcome. Back to the movie, where Greg is now narrating how he and Earl aren't really friends, but just geographically related coworkers who just so happen to both have a Werner Herzog fetish that led to making parody film titles into reality. And I swear I'd watch every single one of these movies at least once and probably eyes wide, but a lot of times. Earl then lets Greg know he might be Rachel's last chance to be with a man and chastises him for thinking that had anything to do with his relative tumescence. Then Greg is innovatively stupid and lets slip to the school about Rachel's diagnosis. But later, she seems not too bothered as he gives her advice on how to handle awkward people. Advice that results in him being lectured by Wolverine, but comes in handy for Rachel when he gets all awkward about it a few seconds later. And then it happens. They actually start to become friends. They become each other's sounding boards, and in the coolest video store I've ever seen, Greg admits that he doesn't think much of himself before Rachel says she's going to make him sit with her friends at lunch. This, of course, results in him making another pillow-cest joke and trying to distract away from it by making fun of a classmate, thus ruining the invisibility he's worked so hard on for so long. He escapes to Mr. McCarthy's office, where he and Earl sneak some of his phenomenal pho that is also apparently pho-ul of drugs. They ride out the high by grabbing ice creams with Rachel, and then Earl spills the beans that they actually are friends, even though Greg doesn't want to call them that because he's in denial, and also that they make movies together. The three of them bond, and for the first time, they purposefully show someone one of the movies they've made. And she seems to like it. Back at school, Greg is confronted with accidentally letting slip that Mr. McCarthy's soup got him high before he has the astonishing revelation that it was probably the cookies that he got from the drug dealer that did it. As we move on, we find Rachel breaking down because she didn't realize how hard losing her hair would be with people telling her she still looks beautiful. Greg gives her another of their movies to watch, and this seems to be good therapy for her. So he heads out to record a scene from A Box of Lips Wow, a parody of Apocalypse Now, where they find a box of tulips during the war that makes them say, wow, huh, I wonder why I love this movie so much.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, Moose Girl Madison interrupts the shoot by telling Greg he has to make Rachel a movie. He gives her a word, the word word, to be specific, because he thinks it's vague enough to not commit, but it will appease Madison, even though we know he is now committed to this task. Later, Rachel gets Greg to apply to college, which he does by writing his personal essay in perfect Herzog cadence and delivery, continuing to make jokes as Rachel heads deeper into treatment. A montage takes us through Rachel working through chemo, and it's time for Greg to actually start making the movie for her. He interviews Rachel's mom, who tries to get him and Earl drunk, apparently, and then some of her classmates, who think the assignment is to be cloying and dull. Rachel continues to go downhill, and no amount of Greg doing the regretful polar bear is pulling her out of it. Greg then promises us for the second time in the movie that Rachel doesn't die at the end of the story, and we're beginning to think that this boy doth protest too much. We then hit another narration montage about the passing days as Greg continues to be there for Rachel and accomplishes the very difficult task of doing exactly zero schoolwork. This leads us to a conversation about prom between Greg and Rachel, where he invites her to prom. She says she's not going, and that Earl told her about the movie they're making for her, and she wants to know when it'll be finished because she's planning on stopping her treatment. Greg's response to this is to completely drop his typical jokester denial and go full into jerkhole denial by chastising a dying friend for wanting to finally die. In some of the movie's most arresting moments, the friendship disintegrates as Greg's self-centeredness causes him to say some of the meanest things he can think of before heading to Earl's house to blame it all on him and get a swift knee to the groin. Then at Greg's lowest, Mr. McCarthy comes through with a touching story about getting to know his father after he passed away through his love of what was, no joke, the inspiration to that Ya Ya Ding Dong song from the Eurovision movie. Anyhow, Greg doesn't appreciate the sappy pep talk and heads home where Earl has dropped off his interview footage on a thumb drive with the simple note, I'm out. The next day, they argue over who has custody of Mr. McCarthy's office during lunchtime as Scorsese talks in the background about The Tales of Hoffman, an opera that shares quite a bit in common with this movie, actually. How convenient. Madison confronts Greg about finishing the movie, and even Madison can see what a selfish, narcissistic butt he's being. Later, Greg's mom comes in to tell him that Rachel is in the hospital to die, and he still can't see past his own pain to process. Back at school, Madison approaches him again, and the chipmunk has had enough of the moose, so he breaks his exterior and tells her off, and then decides to engage in some light fisticuffs with the local high school rapper. And having been the local high school rapper decades ago, I take offense at this portrayal. Earl rushes in to save the day, and they all get kicked out of school before Madison comes out to tell Greg she wants him to go to prom with her. He makes her confirm it isn't a pity date and agrees. Cut to prom night, and Greg is dressed up in his tux, and the limo driver is asking him all about his date. But just when we think he's pulling up to the high school, we realize he's actually at the hospital and has come to see Rachel and to show her the movie, finally. There's no big speech. There's no giant apology. Just two friends in trauma watching a video before cancer does what it so often does, and he is sent to the hallway to mourn. The following 15-minute coda of her life is a lesson in the immortality of love when Greg finally gets what Mr. McCarthy was trying to tell him earlier, as he finds secrets about her inner life hidden throughout her room. As the movie closes, through tears, we realize the narration has been his second application to college, and that because of Rachel's kindness of writing to them on his behalf, he will probably get into college and continue to live his life, more open to those around him and even to himself. And that is Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, which neither of you had seen. What did you guys think?
Meanwhile, Madison is at her house still waiting to get picked up for the goddamn prom.
I think she knew what he decided to do. But.
I don't know about that. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I really like this movie a lot. In fact, I decided to give it a rewatch, not like a serious rewatch this morning before we did this and everything, but I really enjoyed the tone of this, and I really like this main character, Greg. I like how he does his stuff, but like I was, the thing that I think I came away from on this one, and I'm not sure if this is what Jesse Andrews was going for or whatever, but a lot of times it shows what, you know, what living an actual life does to art, where, you know, the beginning of this, when we're seeing what kind of art he's coming out with, it's parody movies of real movies and everything, and there's nothing deep to them, but they are a lot of fun to watch. And you know, he and Earl are always like, oh, they suck or whatever, but I guarantee you everybody in the world would love watching these type of movies because they're so silly and stupid. They're not trying to be in anything. So what happens, of course, when they are tasked to make a movie about the dying girl, they start worrying about it being too perfect and worrying about it not being perfect enough. And they're sort of strangled creatively by the fact that they don't know what to do. And when they try to do something they think is right, which is getting everybody to talk, they realize everybody's saying the same thing. And most of the people they talk to don't even know don't know Rachel at all anyway. So it comes off false and wrong because it's not them. It's not anything that they want that they would normally do. She would probably be perfectly fine if they did some sort of terms of endearment thing, you know, like, you know, terms of inspirement or, you know, or perms of endearment or whatever that they do. You know, she would have been totally fine with that. Meanwhile, he's working on this thing basically mostly off screen. We see a little bit of it when he starts getting on his laptop or whatever, but he's working on this thing that really shows how much work and how much care he has for her. You know, he's always going to be living this life of believing his movie killed her and everything, but you know, it's just one of those things where I think she is overwhelmed with like how much gratitude she has for that movie. It's something that's real and it has nothing to do with some other person's work. It's his original work. And he didn't put all this millions of thought into it. He just did a thing, and it turns out sometimes you just do a thing and it's good, and it doesn't have to be perfect. It's just how it somehow weirdly, and as abstract as that movie is, it shows everything he feels about the situation, about her, all in this one movie. It's really, really interesting. So that's what I got out of it, especially. And then I love the message too, John Bernthal tying the bear back into this in some ways, but John Bernthal's story about his father and how, you know, you can learn things about people even after they die, that really works out, you know, well later on when, you know, Rachel has died and he goes into her room and he notices all the little arty things that she has been doing. Molly Shannon gives her short shrift at the very beginning, like in that interview, saying that when her dad left, she pulled out her scissors and cut up her dad's books. Didn't realize that she was cutting up her dad's books in a very arty way, right? You didn't know that she was cutting, like hollowing them out and like putting little figures and dioramas and stuff in them. And so he finds this out after she dies. He finds that little, like, basically a story of a squirrel jumping across the trees and they turning into different kinds of squirrels as it goes along. Or I think that's, they were squirrels, but I don't know. And exactly what John Bernthal was saying is it's like you were noticing a different person. Who was this person all of a sudden? You didn't know this about her. She wasn't forthcoming about it, but she didn't want to be forthcoming about it. She didn't want to talk about herself at all. So I found that particularly magical and everything. And I just think everything else about this, just the way they interact. I love this dude, Earl, man. I think everybody wants to have a friend like Earl in this. He's just straight up, just real and just funny. And like, it's amazing when you see the contrasts of what happens when Greg's been talking to Rachel for like however long, weeks and stuff. And then Earl comes in and Earl finds out stuff about her and she finds out stuff about him that they hadn't known for weeks. And so he's just a refreshing, great center to that whole relationship and everything. So really, really enjoyed that. I don't think there was one moment in here where I was like, cut that out or do something else or whatever. This is very well realized and I very much enjoyed it.
Well, you're going to get some snark from me today, but I want you guys to all know at the outset that this movie is fine. There's nothing bad about this movie. I did not connect to it the way you both did. I will try and explain that and also say what I believe to be true good things about this movie. The lead, the guy who plays Greg, I think him and the Earl actor, they're perfectly cast. They make this movie work. And there's some really good writing. I like a lot of the lines Greg says. I wrote down, I am like innovatively stupid. I thought that was a great line. And then the line where he says, have you seen me in a tux? It's like when they made the dog wear human clothes. I thought that was very funny. I just found it. I went into it with the wrong attitude, I think. I think I went into it expecting something more than it was. And so I kept waiting for it to be something other than someone is sick and dying in high school rom-com-ish movie. And it really doesn't ever transcend that for me. I do love that they make movies and that they're big movie buffs. And I think that is part of what cements the connection you guys have to this movie and these characters. And it is one of the innovations I think the movie makes. But listen, if I die and you want to get to know me better, don't come to my fucking bedroom and start rifling through all my private shit. Like, that whole scene felt off to me. The squirrels on the wall, I get it. She wrote him a letter, that's touching. But once he starts, like, pulling things off the shelf and opening them, it feels invasive to me. And the story John Bernthal tells was he got to know his dad better after he died because his dad's friends talked about him and told him about him. Not, I went through my dad's office and opened all his drawers and realized that he actually painted now and then. So again, you're catching snark from me here that makes it sound like I think the movie is bad. I really don't. I think for me, it felt about the same as watching The Fault in Our Stars, only there's no like Anne Frank
that hurt
issues. Mm. I'm sorry. I mean,
because I think this is the perfect version of trying to do that movie. Like,
I think it may be, maybe it is. I just felt like I had seen a dozen other movies try, and I was kind of tired of watching that. Like, it feels like a lot of this is just following, I want to say, paint by numbers in a nicer way, but we have a great character actor as the teacher who's cool, but the cool teacher is cool because he just lets them do shit that most teachers wouldn't let them do, but is still kind of a good influence. I just felt like a lot of the movie was following a blueprint for this type of movie. And so while I don't think it's bad, I did not emotionally connect to it. I guess that's really all I would want to say is that hearing you two talk about it made me appreciate it a little bit more, if I'm honest.
Well, I haven't talked about it yet.
And maybe, okay.
I think, by the way, just to insert, I think people know not to go into your room after you've died and go in and inspecting the whole room and everything. don't think anybody's going to do that. And especially since you have now expressly said that you don't want it to happen, no one's going to do that. But in the movie, it seems like she has invited him to do exactly that.
Yeah.
Especially since she wrote, put two little arrows on the book saying, here, open here, show what this, maybe that was for her so she could find it. I don't know. That doesn't seem right.
I agree that was for him. She wanted him to see that. Mm-hmm. I agree. And I guess I can see him inferring that the rest of that scene, she's given consent for that. It felt weird to me when he was doing that, especially since no one knew he was in there. He basically snuck in there. Yeah, I can see what you're saying.
But it was also a welcome space to him for the entire movie. Like, it wasn't a space, like, you know, you get the sense in the entire movie that if he wanted to see that stuff, he could have. Like, you know what I mean? Like, she wasn't actively keeping him out of those things. So, yeah, I didn't feel that same weirdness.
Also, they're all eating the same popsicle in this photo you have showing, but in that scene, they're eating different
it's
popsicles.
Almost also, like they shot that picture on a different day. It's so weird.
We're gonna send posters now.
No. I do want to point out, in case you didn't know this, maybe you didn't, you cannot trust everything you read on the IMDb trivia page for a movie. If you didn't know that, because for this movie's trivia, there's one note that says this movie was shot in chronological order. And then there's another trivia note that says the scene where they sit outside eating the ice cream together was the first day of shooting.
Yeah.
And those two notes are completely incongruous.
Yeah.
Only one can be true.
Which one's
true? Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, so yes, I love this movie, and I love it even more this time through. This doesn't feel to me like a nostalgia thing, especially because, you know, it's just 10 years old. So, you know, I just saw this, you know, 10 years ago for the first time. So it's not something I'm attached to as, you know, like a kid or growing up, that kind of thing. But some of the revelations for me this time through are almost in direct counter to the things you were saying, Jeremy. I think at almost every instance, this movie makes a different decision than most movies like this would make. And I think that's most evident with how it ends. I think it's most evident with that the final thing he says to her is, this isn't maybe what I wanted to say, but here it is. And that's it. That's the last conversation he has. They never get to have their big resolution, apology, you know, those kind of things. Earl, after he says I'm out, never shows up again in this movie. Never shows up again in this movie. Most movies like this would have a coda of some sort where he and Earl are like, yeah, man, you know, I understand you're going through a lot or whatever.
He does, right? He shows up at the funeral.
He shows up again.
Or not the funeral, the wake or whatever.
They see each other in the
They talk to each other. He walks up the stairs and he follows him, but he's not with him. He starts looking through the window and sees the people or whatever. So we don't even know if they're still friends after
they're
all
that. They're in proximity, but they don't have that, you know, resolution or whatever. And so just things like that, choices like that, I noticed throughout. I feel like the movie even goes to lengths to say, this isn't that movie. You know, you mentioned romance. This movie goes to great lengths to make sure you understand, this is not a romance. This is not a romance. This is a friendship. It's not Jeremy.
It's not Jeremy.
I think you're putting that on it. I think the movie, both textually and in what it's showing us, is showing us that these are two human beings who enjoy each other's company and like being together, make each other laugh. And yes, in some people's world, that means, you know, men and women can't be friends. You know what I mean? Like they have to eventually be romantic or whatever. But this movie never goes there for purposes. And that's doing different. That is definitely different than any other kind of movie like this would do. So the movie is taking great lengths to say, you know, this is different here. This isn't where we kiss with the heat of 1,000 suns or whatever he says during that. And I'll just go into that for a second thing. I just think this movie is hilarious. And you mentioned it as well. It's so well written. There's that another example to me of how this movie does something different with something that could be seen as a trope. That drug trip scene is different than any other accidentally on drugs scene I've ever seen. The way it's portrayed, the way they go through it, you know, this, the fact that Earl pops up on his phone as Princess Leia saying there were drugs in the soup or whatever he says. The soup had drugs is what he says. Like, as Princess Leia, you know, hologram, the soup had drugs, just cracks me up. Every time. I will say, this is one of the hardest recaps I've ever had to write. This movie is so fast and so tight. And like, every time I'm trying to write something about the previous scene, there are three more things that have happened, you know, in the following scenes that, that I'm trying to also include. And I just left a lot of stuff out just because this movie is that kind of mile a minute script, which I really, really like. This movie hits differently after my recent Criterion Collection binge. You know, like, a lot of these movies that they're parodying, I have now seen. You know, like, I recently just saw The 400 Blows and, you know, The Seventh Seal, like, all these things. And so that's, it's fun to me to kind of, you know, have that extra level of appreciation for the parodies. So, yeah, I just think there's something really interesting that this movie is saying about Greg. See, most of these movies, when you're talking about, you know, a terminally ill romantic interest or even friend or whatever, a lot of them are about the relationship, and that becomes the driving factor. What we realize in this movie, or at least what I realize, especially this time through, is this is always a character study about Greg. This has been, from the beginning to the end, about his inability to live in the real world. His inability, everything he encounters, he is in denial about. He's in denial about his own possible good looks. He's in denial about, you know, his friendship with Earl, right? Like, he talks about they're not friends, they're coworkers. Every scene, in one way or another, leads us to this understanding of Greg as this person who isn't open to actually understanding the people around. He thinks he has found the answer, and what he has found is isolation, and he doesn't realize it until the end. And once he realizes what both Mr. McCarthy was trying to tell him, and that there was this human being that he thought he was getting to know and really was just still all centered in himself. He is narcissistic through this entire movie. To make her choosing to die about himself is kind of that final part where you just go, oh, he's got to change. Like, he's got some real issues he has to deal with. And, you know, she tells him the story about counting squirrels in the forest, and then to see that she has drawn these squirrels on her, you know, wallpaper. And it's just like, oh, there's this whole other element of people that only exists if I'm willing to open myself up to them. And that's where he ends with his college essay. And I just think it's a beautifully written through line for that character. And I believe it's truly a character study on him more than it's about their relationship and her fighting cancer.
Yeah, it's the movie basically says that he's just been playing it safe the whole time. Yeah. It sets you up so that you're not hated, which is great, but it also means you can't be loved either, because you don't take any kind of risks or chances. And so is the question of, do you just want to be on this line the entire time where people are just kind of like, that guy's that guy. And that's all they really know about him. Or do you want to actually interact with people, right, and like, risk being hated at times in order to, you know, sometimes be loved or liked or, right, you know, truly thought of as a, you know, as a great person or whatever. So, anyway,
there you go.
I wanted to say something else about this, but I'm going to save it because it might interfere with the super secret double feature. Ooh, so, okay. Let's see what our super secret double feature is.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Jeremy, you go.
Oh, shit.
I've got a million, so you don't have to worry.
Well, I kind of want to... I have one that I'm choosing, but I kind of want to name another one.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give you my first, I'll give you my main one. I'll let you go, and then I'll come back to my second one.
I'd say go ahead and say that other one, because I've already written down like a bunch, so you can't possibly ruin it.
It it was, I think, a very lovely double feature that celebrates creativity and art and making movies would be Be Kind, Rewind.
Sure.
It doesn't have a lot of the other elements from Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. And that's not my official choice, but I did find that kindred spirit of the regular people making movies and entertaining their friends or themselves with it. But the one I ultimately would choose, I'm such a dick. We Live in Time, because it has a woman who's dying of cancer and chooses to go out on her own terms. And also, I didn't really connect to that movie.
And also, I love that movie, so it works really well.
I wasn't going to say that, but I did know that. So there you go.
Interestingly enough, Be Kind, Rewind was the one that I was going to choose, but I had some...
You made a promise, Chris. Bastard. You said it wouldn't matter.
It doesn't.
You said you had a whole list.
It doesn't. What is about the I have a whole list
there you
means
go.
That
there
Be Kind,
go.
Rewind can't go. Be picked.
Okay. Fair enough.
So, yes, that was the one I was going to pick because of the Swede versions of the movies and everything like that. I think I had mentioned Be Kind, Rewind also in reference to movies like when we did Sing Street, I did Rushmore as a Super Secret double feature. So I also thought of Rushmore. I also thought of Sing Street. But I didn't want to do those as well because we've already covered that ground and everything like that. So I'm going to go with Super 8 on this one because of the making the movies, being a kid and Super 8 is a completely different movie, mind you, but it does have all of this, like, you know, what you know, growing up and learning how to shoot films and all this type of stuff is in there. I think it would make a pretty good double feature, even though one is a cancer comedy, what if that's what you want to call it, and the other is a sci-fi Spielberg esque type of movie or whatever, but I think it works out pretty well, so that's what I'm going to go with. The other one I thought of was said in the chat was Spontaneous. Would be a pretty good one as well. So yeah, I had a whole list. Don't worry about your Be Kind, Rewind there, mister.
Well, I didn't even think about Spontaneous, and I feel like a champion for that movie. But that's a good call.
I thought for sure you were going to say Spontaneous, in fact.
That's wild.
All right. Let's go on to what our homework is going to be next week, and it's my turn. And fellas, let's do something light, really light. It's called At Close Range from 1986. It is not light. You can tell by the fact that you can tell by the fact that Sean Penn and Christopher Walken are in it. I picked this movie. I picked this movie largely out of, and you guys can follow my lead or just completely ignore it. But I was hoping that you guys would do the same thing. This movie was shot in my hometown of Franklin, Tennessee. It is I remember it being a pretty good movie, possibly even solidly good. I don't know if it's definitely not perfect, but you've got two really huge heavy hitters in this, and you have a lot of other actors who are like sort of getting their start and who will become big down the line. This movie has a lot of downtown Franklin sites, including I believe the Franklin Square, which still to this day has a Confederate soldier statue in the middle of it. but it also has. It also has my high school, my future high school is in this movie, and my oldest brother's former high school in this movie when the movie came out after he went to that high school. So it's a lot of stuff in there. I just wanted to kind of like not only do this movie, but just kind of go over the whole thing with this being filmed in my hometown. And this was just when like Sean Penn and Madonna got married and the paparazzi apparently like swarmed Franklin trying to get pictures of them and stuff. So like a lot of interesting stuff happened around this movie and everything. But anyway, I believe this movie's on Tubi. You can find it on Tubi, and it's also on what's the other one that it's on? It's on some other free Pluto, I think.
Pluto.
Yeah, it's on Pluto TV, so you can find it on there. But this movie is, I remember it being pretty good. It definitely fits the mold of what this show is about, trying to find sort of uncovered gems and things like that. So that will be next week. All right. That is going to do it for this episode. Chat, once again, thank you for coming out. We appreciate you very much. That's going to do it for this week. We will see you next time. See ya.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Bye. Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
You just came, what?
I just came from set, the set of Geely, where I was filming the movie Geely.
I thought you said I just came from sex, and I was like, that's not a joke Aaron makes. I wanted to tell you guys a quick story that happened to me this morning. It won't take very long. I was pulling out of Kroger with my Starbucks that I get every morning, and I'm turning right, and there's a woman to my left who's going to turn left onto this major highway, and her right front tire is really low. So I pull up beside her and I honk and she looks and I roll down my window and I wave and I point at her front tire and she waves back, smiles and pulls out into the highway.
Yeah.
Like I feel like I did the good deed behavior perfectly and she just was unable to receive my communication. For whatever reason, she thought maybe I recognized her from high school and was just waving. I don't know, but
trying to pick her up.
I guess she's probably on the side of the road right now with a flat tire, but I tried to help.
Yeah. People never take any kind of message on the road as anything that they may have to do. Like I've run into so many people who are driving down the road without their headlights on, like late at night. You flash your lights at them, and they just you look back when they pass you, and they never turn their lights on. They never turn them on. I've stopped doing it because people just never heed the warning.
I just think we all have grown to completely distrust every other driver on the road.
That's true.
Sure,
and for good reason.
Very good reason. It's kind of what the internet is. Only I mean it's like as per. Because we're all anonymous out there, and everybody's just angry and out for themselves, and that was our first clue about how the internet would work was driving around in traffic.
We should have known the internet would be like roads. Do you remember in the 80s and 90s the scaremonger rumors about gangs driving around with their headlights off?
Mm-hmm.
And if you flash them to tell them to turn it on, they'll kill you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Why did we ever believe stupid shit like that? Why did we ever think gangs operate?
Because
like,
why would anyone lie to us, Jeremy? Why would anyone lie to us? That's what we
because
were thinking.
It happened to a friend of their cousin, Jeremy. Oh, they
see.
Had first-hand information.
I don't want to get into the whole COVID vaccine stuff over again. Just briefly, though, it was amazing how many people I knew who don't believe in the vaccine, and their circle of friends don't believe in the vaccine, but they always knew somebody who got it and died. And I'm in a circle of friends who all believed in it, all got it, and nobody died. So... most of the time they always picked some other cause of death and they ignored some other cause of death and blamed the vaccine, but especially for celebrities who were dying at the time. But anyway, don't want you to get into that whole rigmarole. But that was amazing to me. Like, how come I don't know anybody? I know everybody I know got it. So why didn't somebody I know die?
Oh, I did. I died. I got the vaccine and I died. You didn't know that?
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
I should have told you.
You've been talking to us from the grave since 2021?
No, I came back to life like Jon Snow, the Red Queen, which she raised me from the dead. Shit, I just spoiled season 5.
Shit. Shit. So I guess this could wait for the actual episode, but I think it works better as an outtake. So like last week, I was sitting there talking about how Jeremy and I went to that book signing in New York. That was back in 2015. And Jesse Andrews was to our left and Nick Offerman was to our right.
Yeah.
And I had no idea at the time that Nick Offerman was in this movie. I didn't know he was in this movie last week until I started watching the movie. And so I sat there and wondered, I mean, they had to have known each other by this point, because that was 2015 when the book signing happened. The movie came out in 2015. So I was just wondering if they were like kind of palling around like afterwards and all that. I was like, it's amazing to me that I sat there and watched Jesse Andrews to our left and Nick Offerman to our right that whole time, didn't realize they'd done something together.
Man, it's gotta be, imagine what it must feel like to write a book and have the movie come out the same year the book comes out, because that's how good your book is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's got to feel awesome.
Did it come out? Did the book come out the same year, or did it?
We were there for a book con, and there, me and Earl and the Dying Girl banners were all over the place.
It could be either because it was still a hot book at the time. Like, I don't remember when the book came out. But,
okay, so I was wrong. Yeah, book came out in 2012.
Yeah, and so, like, I think that, yeah, he's going to sign that book, obviously, because that was still a pretty hot property at the time and everything. But, yeah, it didn't take long, did it? 2012 comes out with a book. 3 years later, it's a movie.
Yeah, it's like Andy Weir with The Martian.
Yeah. It's weird. I would never have any qualms about watching a trailer for that latest what's the project
Hail Mary.
What is it called?
Hail Mary.
Project Hail Mary. And someone was like, "Oh, don't watch it. It's got a big surprise reveal." And I'm like, "I would have never had a problem watching this trailer until you said that. Now it shows up and I'm like, I don't want to watch it."
It's so weird. It's like, it's such a misunderstanding. Like,
mm-hmm.
Aaron, I realize you're a completely separate perspective to this conversation because you don't watch any trailers, but if...
I try not to.
Like, that needs to be in the trailer. And people thinking it's a spoiler just don't know the story.
Okay.
Well, I'll just watch it. That's the point, right? Like, they don't know the story. Like, if you want to read the book first.
I'm saying it's not... It doesn't... What the trailer shows that people think is they show too much is going to happen 20 minutes into the movie. The movie is about what people think is the trailer say are sharing too much.
Here's the movie I'll compare it to, and I think works as Companion. You remember when Companion came out? And apparently, both you guys saw Companion, didn't you? You've seen?
Oh, yeah.
I've seen Companion, yeah.
So there are two kind of really fun story turns in that story, and I think the trailer gives away the first one, which is really early in the movie. But I didn't know either of them because I hadn't seen the trailer, and that first one hit hard. Like, I loved it so much because I'm experiencing the story for the first time. Now, it's the same thing you're saying. It doesn't spoil the movie if you know that. It's kind of the point of the movie. But if you don't know it, there's something unique and interesting about discovering it, maybe like you did when you read the book. I don't know, but
what you're doing is arguing for not watching trailers, and I'm not going to disagree with you. I'm just saying the average American chooses which movies to watch.
Right, marketing wise, they have to put it in there. Is what you're saying? Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
I totally get it.
It's like it spoils as much as saying Ryan Gosling is in it. It's as big a spoiler as that.
Aaron's like, "Oh fuck, Ryan Gosling's in it."
How dare you?
Would I rather be able to go through life and just be able to watch movies without the trailer? Yes, but trailers have become an intricate part of me watching movies over the years, especially, I mean, that's how it started. And then it's what it became when I was a projectionist. I fell in love with trailers a lot of times. I loved trailers.
Same, honestly.
So that type of thing, like, the problem is, exactly, with the marketing issue is that the theater movies would never, they wouldn't be a successful venture if they couldn't show you what's supposed to be good about the product. Yeah, with Aaron, he knows he's going to watch everything that comes out anyway.
Right.
So there's no marketing issue here.
Correct.
But for me, it's just a part of the experience of watching
movies.
It's
not like this is... a trailer for Empire Strikes Back and it contains Luke, I'm your father. It's not like that.
Well,
I will say that Zemeckis clearly did that back in 2000. He went too far with What Lies Beneath and Castaway with his trailers. Because What Lies Beneath tells you the biggest surprise in the trailer, and Castaway even has a part at the end of the, near the end of the trailer, that says, wow, they had a casket for you. We already knew he got off the island and he was everything. And like, I guess we know he gets off the island. He's Tom Hanks, but still, I didn't need to know that.
That's amazing.
Imagine if he didn't. Imagine if the movie ends with him just slowly starving to death.
Yeah. And a bottle comes onto the island and it says, by the way, I got married again. I don't give a fuck about you.
The final shot is just his skeleton at a campfire with a volleyball between his bones of his knees.
Oh, we just improved Castaway.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.